Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Pleased to have back Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Old Break Botanical Gardens in Madison. We're going to talk with him about incorporating native plants into your garden and take your gardening questions as well. Have you mixed natives into your landscape? How's it working for you? What would you like to know about designing with natives? Join in. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Epping, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry, as always.
Well, adding native plants to the non-natives in your garden is, I think, it's becoming a popular way to create a landscape. Maybe talk about the philosophy behind that.
Yeah, you bet. You know, a gentleman, professor at, out east, an entomologist by the name of Doug Tallamy, has written a couple of fantastic books, and the latest is called Nature's Best Hope. I'm guessing you've had him on the show once or twice over the years.
We have him scheduled for July 14th at 11:45. So he will be on coming up pretty quickly.
Awesome. Go ahead. We had him on our winter webinar series here at Olbrich, and we had close to 200 people tune in. And I don't think we've ever had such an overwhelming positive response from everyone and how grateful they were to hear, his philosophy, his research, his message about how important it really is to use native plants. And we've been kind of on this kick for a few years, and you know, we've never had anything against native plants. We use them like we used all the other plants, and more looking at them for their ornamental characteristics, but. Now, you know, we've seen the light and we know how important natives are in the landscape, and they're equally as beautiful, if not more beautiful, as plants from all over the world. And so we have incorporated both. And that's something I think we all should be trying to do. And why? Because the native plants support native insects. And native insects are the base of the food chain or the food web. They convert the energy that plants capture from the sun and nutrients and such from the soil. And the insects then eat them and harness that energy for all the other creatures to eat. Do you like birds, Larry?
I love birds.
Right, don't we all? And without insects, birds can't survive. Doug Tallamy points out that something like 96% of birds feed their young only insects. And so if there's no insects, there's no new baby birds. And, the decline in our bird populations over the last 30 years is frightening. And it won't get any better unless we help them out. In many ways, but one of them is provide food for them. So, converting some of our lawns to more garden space that utilizes native plants is a big step in the right direction. And it's something that we're doing more and more here at the garden and my own personal garden as well. And so at home, if it's not native, it's not going in anymore because I have a lot of non-natives already in my landscape. So I'm trying to strike a better balance of both. And Doug doesn't say, get rid of every non-native plant that's in your garden because, we want people to love their gardens. We want them to be beautiful. So, people want to convert more lawn areas that really contribute nothing to the food web to gardens that incorporate both native and non-native plants. So there's a place for both. But at this point, a lot of gardens really lack a great number of native plants. And if you go to your a garden center or a big box store and walk around the plants, you know, to see the nursery areas to see the plants that they have, it's sometimes hard to even find a native plant. I walked into one of the big building box stores. I won't mention Home Depot, but it was them. And I perused all the plantings, and if there was 1% of the plants that they offered that were native, I'd be surprised. So we as consumers of plants need to be better educated as to what it is we're after and go to those places that offer them. Because if you think you're just going to get a native plant by picking up anything anywhere, more than likely that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Is it tricky to, I mean, at Olbrich, so those are beautiful gardens. I see the natives out there. Is it tricky to kind of incorporate them into the landscape?
Actually, it's no. You know, so many of our right. native plants are beautiful. You know, what's so funny is that, well, I think it's just human nature. We always want something that we don't have. We always think something that isn't around us is exotic and, you know, is more desirable. And it's true all around the world. So I go to England and see all of our native plants in their gardens, and they think they are the greatest thing going. And then they do some breeding work with them and come up with bigger flowers and all those things. So they appreciate, sometimes I think they appreciate our native plants more than we do. I think that's changing, of course, and I think people are starting to see the light and realize that, you know, our plants all around us are gorgeous, and you know what? They're becoming more and more rare because the development in this country, each and every year, I think Doug points out something like 40 million acres a year are of our native plantings, our natural areas are being overrun with development. And that's the size of like Yellowstone Park every single year. We're losing nature and native plants. So what Doug says is, you know, our gardens need to become the next national park. In fact, he calls it Homegrown National Park. He has this great website that you should all check out. And become a member. You can, you know, you can sign up and yeah. So I shouldn't try to steal his thunder because you have him coming up. But we're all such disciples of his here that it's hard not to talk about him and the great things he's doing. And you know, we're trying to do the same. And you know, it's like I said, it's not something brand new to us, but we're putting more of an emphasis on it in every part of the organization. In fact, our plant sale is becoming more, you know, native plant friendly as well, and trying to educate people who come through the gardens, you know, about the insects that we see, creating bee and wasp habitat for, you know, pollinators and butterflies. And there are lots and lots of nesting birds at Olbrich. And, you know, I'm proud to say that we spray very, very few pesticides in the garden anymore. In fact, we rid the rose garden, which we actually changed the name of this year to the tower garden, because the only way we could grow a decent looking rose was to constantly spray them with fungicides and insecticides and all those things. And that's just not what we like to do. And that's not what we want to show people, you know, day in and day out. So we changed the name because everybody would come and say, well, where are the roses? You know, and it's took them out because they didn't spray them anymore.
I'm wondering how you're approaching the landscaping around the new Family Learning Center at Olbrich.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for asking. So we just are opening up the new Frauchy Family Learning Center, which is a beautiful education facility. We've never had a dedicated space before. And so we've had great support from the community and City of Madison to build this beautiful new platinum LEED certified building. So very, very environmentally friendly. And so because of that, we also want to make the landscape as equally as beneficial to the environment. So we did put in all of our woody plantings last year, trees, shrubs, vines, and I designed that in a way that we created some formality with those plantings. Most of those are native. They may be like a variety or cultivar of a native plant, which has, good and bad points to it, but yet they are native. Insects will utilize them and that sort of thing. But I wanted to create a sort of some formality in the landscape because, on the ground layer, the perennials and such will be planted in a more naturalistic way, in a more, sort of wild manner, if you will, and utilizing, the majority of the plants we'll be utilizing will be native, but we have some non-natives in there too. But all, good for pollinators and such. And, so putting that sort of more naturalistic, wild sort of style amongst the formality of the trees and shrubs and such, make it feel, like it's a garden, if you will. It doesn't seem messy in the eyes of many people, that sort of thing. There's also a beautiful rain garden that will be included in it. We're in the process of planting it up right now. We have the first section of perennials in. This weather is not cooperating very well with the very dry conditions and the heat. Like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? But, we're plugging away at it amongst all of our other daily duties that we're doing at this time of year. So come September, when we're going to have a grand opening for the building and the landscape, everything will be in place and everybody can see it in its completion. Of course, it'll take a few years to fully mature, but it'll be right. Well on its way. And I'm really looking forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it, too. It's going to be a lot of fun. Jeff Epping, our guest, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens, talking about adding native plants to your non-native plants in your garden as a way to help our environment, help the insects, and help the environment. You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Great to have him along. We've been talking about adding native plants to your non-native garden. If you have some native plants, put them in. It's a great way to improve the landscape and the insects and everything else for that matter. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Barbara has been waiting a bit from Grand Marsh. Barbara, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a terrible problem. I want to put native plants in my garden section, but I inadvertently planted bamboo, and that is an insidious plant. I want to get rid of it. I don't know how. It just keeps on spreading and taking over.
Yeah. Jeff, any thoughts on that?
I wonder if it's polygonum. I think it's Raynordii, which is, they call it heavenly bamboo, which is a very interesting name because it's anything but, as you know. Oftentimes before we, establish any garden, we have to get rid of some of the bad guys that unfortunately are a reality in the world today. And invasive species are something that we'll be dealing with, forever. Just the way it is. So with some of those really difficult invasives, you might want to check on the with the Wisconsin DNR, their invasive species site, or folks there. I have a lot of experience on eliminating a particular invasive species, and I think that would be probably your best bet. Oftentimes, unfortunately, we have to resort to herbicides to get rid of some of the worst of them, but not always. And sometimes there's different options depending on, you know, how long you want to wait to be able to plant the area. I always, you know, when we're dealing with invasives, sometimes, you know, using a chemical of some sort to rid of those worst invasives and start the healing process through replanting and use of natives and others, you know, I feel like it's a justified trade-off. But like I say, it's not always necessary to use those. So I would check that out. Check out the DNR's website or give those folks a call and they could point you in the right direction.
Barb, thank you very much. Barbara from Grand Marsh, appreciate it. Let's go to Kay in Sauk Prairie. Kay, hello.
Hi. I have a small native southern Wisconsin prairie here, and I have kept it separate from my perennials only because I want my prairie to be seeding itself and kind of going through its normal cycle of who's going to be dominant and how it all works out. So I've kept them separate, but I know when you collect seed to help in restorations and things like that where it kind of matters, you try to collect locally. So my question is, how do you define a native plant in terms of what Jeff is talking about? Because you can buy, I mean, it's native in Pennsylvania or it's native in Montana or whatever. How far would that range be for him? And where does he feel that nativars fall in this whole plan?
Hmm. Good questions, Kay. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it kind of depends on who you talk to about what's native and non-native. I mean, that's a great question because really the best thing you can do is try to find plants that are genetics or genotype of the area that you live in. That would be ideal. It's not always as easy as that sounds unless you're willing to collect seed natively or, you know, locally and propagate them yourselves. You know, if there's a local nursery available to, say, Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, you know, Neil DeBoll is, you know, fantastic. A prairie advocate and has been for years in use of native plants. And so I'm sure he is trying to collect local genetics in his seed collection and when they grow their plants. So, and that's true of many specific native plant nurseries around the Midwest. And there's a number of them out there. The World Wide Web is a great place to do a little research to find out who's closest to you and source those plants as locally as possible. You mentioned nativars, some people call them, or cultivars, or selections of native plants. Again, you know, if we're using those in a garden situation, I still believe that they're better than using exotic plants. The gene pool is much reduced. So it depends on the cultivar, because some are seed strains, which have more genetic diversity in them, and some are actually clones where they are propagated clonally, if you will. So every plant has the exact same genes in it. So still better than a non-native plant, probably not as good as having something locally collected and grown. But again, you know, a garden can be all those things and still serve a great purpose for our insects and pollinators and such. Mount Cuba is a botanic garden out in the East Coast in Delaware, and they have a research program. They're very heavily focused on native plants. And they'll take a group of, say, phlox is a good one, and they'll gather together all the different cultivars that are available out there, and they rate them not only on performance, but they rate them on how attractive they are to pollinators. And so it's really a good resource if you want to select those plants, cultivars that are probably the best at making our insects happy and thrive and such. So check them out. They have free evaluations online, and you can check out. So Mount Cuba Center, great, great botanic garden that's heavily focused on native plants. And there's a great example of a beautiful garden using only natives.
Thank you again, Kay, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's give Mike in La Crosse a chance. Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Yeah, here's my situation. I've got an area that it's pretty long, probably close to 100 feet long, 30 feet wide, that I've got primarily bee balm and common milkweed. I do have some purple coneflowers in there, but I'm looking for suggestions to compete and mutually support these plants that are good to also attract and support pollinators.
Now, that's a pretty big space. Are you thinking about trying to use more seed or plugging that in with what we typically, bigger space like that, now we use what they call plugs, where you have about, 30 to 40 plants per tray, as sort of a standard flowering flat. And that's what we're using with our learning center planting for the meadow type look that we're going for. It's a lot less expensive. And if you can, tend to them a little bit, they're not extremely hard to tend to, but you can get a lot more plants for your money versus a gallon size plant. Seed would be the cheapest, but again, that takes a little more time and management. Are you,
good idea. What I'm concerned about is this, I've got these mature, the milkweed have their network of roots, and so do the bee balm. And so, I actually got to punch a hole in there to get into in some of the places there that the roots are so thick. And so that's why I'm looking for ideas, particularly with something that can hold its own against these plants.
Right. So I would suggest I mentioned Prairie Nursery earlier. They have a great website, kind of lists all the different plants in there and such. And you could even give them a call or another prairie specialist nursery that might be able to help you out with that. But, many of the more rigorous native prairie plants should be able to compete just fine. I mean, if this space is solid with the plants that you just talked about, then you're going to have to punch some holes in there, so to speak.
Yeah.
And give the other plants a chance. I mean, they will compete in the future, but putting a small plug or even a gallon with a small root system next to something that's been there for a number of years, you'll definitely have to manage those two. Otherwise, they'll get overrun before they can become competitive with what you already have. So you'll have a little bit of work on your hands to sort of give them a competitive advantage to survive for the long haul. A lot of the native prairie grasses like panicum or switchgrass and little blue stem, big blue stem, spirobolus. I always like to mix a lot of our ornamental grasses or native grasses, if you will, in with herbaceous plants to kind of give it a nice sort of matrix between the two. And that's typical of most prairies that you would see. So, there's lots of different plants out that'll work for you. You're just going to have to, work with it to get them incorporated without being overrun by what you have.
Yeah. You can join in too, by the way. And by the way, thanks, Mike. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Listener emailed that about half of her yard is an established forest, and it has quite a bit of buckthorn in the mid-understory level. She has several other invasives she's working to remove. But here's the thing, she enjoys the privacy of the middle and understory cover that it provides, the buckthorn provides. Is there a comparable native option to plant in place of buckthorn? Something, she's looking for kind of a screen, I think, in there.
Right. And I often hear that from people, and I've worked with a number of people with my consulting side of my life. And when they have established woodlands, which are absolutely, you know, beautiful and overrun with buckthorn and honeysuckle, their first question is like, what can we put back? Because we don't want to see what's beyond. Our native hazel nut, Corylus americana, is a good one that coexists in with a woodland. And, you know, woodlands are of different magnitude, right? Some are more dense and shady and than others. So sometimes you have to take advantage of maybe pockets in your woodland where you get a little more sunlight in for some of these understory shrubs and understory trees. So also things like ironwood is a good shade tolerant understory species. I'm a deer hunter, and I often find it growing in the understory of woods that I hunt west of Madison. So when I say hazelnut, hornbeam or ironwood,
yeah,
which Ostraea virginiana. There are some Sambucus pubens, is I think the red elderberry is a good understory shrub that would do well. Pagoda dogwood is also a great understory tree. Put that in a little bit moister areas because it's doesn't like it to be really, really droughty. Yeah, so those are some start, maybe some types of serviceberry. Witch hazel is another one that does well for us in that type of situation.
All right, excellent. Thanks for that question. Ivy in Evansville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. What you're talking about is something I've tried to achieve with my really small yard in the middle of town, and been fairly successful in attracting birds, 21 species of warblers over time. But you were just talking about the pagoda dogwood and hazelnut and elderberry, and they're really great shrubs. They reproduce on their own, and you can cut them back, and they'll grow back, and you can keep them small. And for a smaller yard, they're great, and they provide a lot of wildlife food. But one of the vines that I planted, having researched invasives and stuff, is a native honeysuckle. I don't believe it's native to Wisconsin. It's I may say this wrong, but Lonicera sempervirens. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's native to more of southern United States. But it grows, it's great for hummingbirds, and it's not invasive, and it doesn't cling to buildings. So if you like hummingbirds, and it produces blooms all year long, and I mix non-natives with my natives. So some of the other plants that you can find the seeds for and easily grow are cup plants and Joe Pye weed. And a lot of those are, I found they are great for the pollinators. And then the seeds are used by like goldfinches and chickadees later on if you leave them. And you can cut them back so they don't grow that tall. And it's been really good. And I found these plants to be really tough. And I do mix them with some cultivars too. But so thank you. Mm-hmm.
Oh, those are great comments. Great comments. Yes, and you're right. Lonicera sempervirens is native to the U.S., not native to Wisconsin, but it's a good, you know, it's a good plant. And another one that, you know, some people turn their nose up at is Virginia creeper, or Parthenocissus quinquifolia. I love the vine. It can grow across the floor of a woodland as well as grow up the trees. It's got gorgeous fall color. It has a lot of different insects that feed upon it as well. And so those are some great comments. And yeah, so many of our native prairie plants are so well adapted to, you know, our growing conditions. And when we're in a drought like we are now, I look around at the plants in the garden, and most of the natives are those that are looking the best, even with this heat and lack of rain. And you're right, like birds eating The seeds, a lot of fun. There's some native coreopsis, like tall coreopsis, coreopsis tripteris, loaded with finches in the fall. You mentioned Joe pieweed, Eupetorium. There's a number of species of those and a number of species of silphiums. You mentioned cup plant. There's also compass plant. And very interesting plants with interesting habits and foliage. Wild quinine is another great one, Parthenium integrifolium. And when that's in bloom, you just count the crazy variety of pollinators that are on those flowers. It's really, really fun. There's just, so many great native plants that we can put to use in our gardens.
Thanks very much, Ivy, for that. Lisa in Whitefish Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Lisa.
Okay, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Some of my questions were answered just now with ivies. I, too, have a small city lot, and I started planting it over 20 years ago with native plants, and it got so overgrown after time that my neighbors didn't like this because I'd leave it up in the winter, for the seeds and things. But the main thing was I got so many pests. I had ticks, including a Lone Star tick that got on me. I had a dead West Nile virus crow in my yard. And then I had mice everywhere. So the mice were the final straw, and I took most of the garden out. And now I have just borders instead of my whole yard. And I was looking for things, too. I know about cutting back the Joe Pye weed, and I have the cup plant and many of those plants you mentioned. But I'm trying to find things that might stay small anyway to put in the front of the borders, that I'm not always out there cutting everything back. And second, if you have any suggestions about pests like that, because I know they're still in my yard. I mean, you just can't get rid of that stuff. If you have any suggestions, I'd appreciate that too.
Sure. I think, if you look through the gamut of native plants, there are plants that are short and there's plants that are tall and there's plants that are really tall. Like I mentioned, tall coreopsis gets the 6 to 7 feet tall. Vernonia or ironweed, we've gotten up to 10 or 12 feet tall at the garden. But there's also, smaller growing shorter plants like, the columbines, the native Allium cernuum or nodding onion. And if you have some amount of shade, there's quite a number of shade plants like the native phlox, Phlox divaricata. There's a number of sedges. Which used to be lawn, is now a little meadow, a sedge meadow, if black for a better word. And I have mostly native sedges in there, but I also mixed in some wildflowers, like columbine, which is very attractive to hummingbirds and such early in the season. Shooting star, which is a great plant. There's some cone flowers that are in that mix as well. And I put some non-native bulbs in there, so I had some really nice early spring color even before the shooting stars and Virginia bluebells and those spring ephemerals were in bloom. But in that garden, I still manage it. I don't just plant it and walk away. And you mentioned that, it was good in the beginning, I think, and then it got, bigger and wilder and whatever. It's still gardening. You're still going to have to remove a few plants here and there because all plants want to proliferate and they're going to cast seed and they're going to germinate. And some plants are more aggressive or dominant than others. And if they reseed a lot, like cup plant, the previous caller mentioned, I had that in a previous garden and I let it go to seed one year because the birds loved it. And I had hundreds upon hundreds of seedlings the next season. And so I had to weed those out. And when they were small, it was no big deal. But if I wouldn't have done that, I would have had a garden of cup plant. And that's with taking everything over. So it's still gardening. And like we were mentioning earlier, even in our it's native woodlands that are all around us. Invasive species are a reality, and we, so to speak, have to even start gardening our native areas to get rid of those invasive species, to manage those on a regular basis. And there's companies that, you know, make their living doing that. So keep that in mind too. If you have if you have an issue with invasives, there are companies out there that specialize in that. They do it very well, very efficiently, and then you know, you can move forward with better native plants and better things. So as far as the, all the creatures that are out there, yeah, they're out there. The mice, and then the owls that eat those, or fox. We have mink at the garden that also eat some of the smaller, you know, rodents out here at the garden. So it's an ecosystem, right? And so you're creating habitat for that. I think that's awesome. I don't worry about mice too much, I guess, or chipmunks and all those things, if they're in balance, of course. Now, ticks and that sort of thing is another story, and I think that's probably for another show with someone who has better expertise than I. But I know that's becoming more of a problem with climate change as well. We're seeing a lot of insects becoming a problem here in the north that never used to be. So, I guess that's my thoughts.
Lisa, thanks again. Appreciate it. Jane in Wausau emailed that after seeing the beautiful itch peony blossoms at Olbrich Garden, she ordered a plant for her garden. It's been in the ground for 5 years at least. At the most, it gets 2 feet tall. It never buds or blossoms. She gives it a little bit of organic fertilizer once or twice a year. Do you have other suggestions on how she can get it to blossom?
I wonder if it's in full sun, because that would be the very first thing I would say, is that, because I've had peonies, and we've had some here that, you know, over time the trees in the vicinity have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and the shade has suddenly become too much for them to, you know, put out a good floral display. So that might be the biggest part of it. Also, you know, there's a particular depth, and I don't have it in my head right now, that peonies are supposed to be planted at. Sometimes if they're too deep, they don't bloom as well. Look that up online. I'm sure that information is out there with the American Peony Society or someone else. But if that were the case in the fall, you could dig that up and move it to the proper height, or maybe move it into more sun at the same time, if that's a part of the issue. But peonies in general are pretty tough plants, you know, peonies, daylilies, that sort of thing. And and again, you know, those types of plants are part of our garden heritage too. So I'm not saying, you know, we're talking about mixing the natives in, and we can easily, you know, have both.
Our guest today, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Great to have him back, and thank you for joining in. Questions, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Louis in Oconto has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Louis.
Oh. My question is this. In southern Door County, have a problem with erosion on a hillside. That in that area, a lot of rock and some soil, but it's really hard to get anything to grow there. Want to know if there's something that you can plant to help hold that soil so it just doesn't keep washing down with rain.
Say, well, without seeing that site, but if it's you know, if it's a super severe slope, and it keeps eroding on a regular basis, it's going to be hard to get anything established out there without sort of stabilizing the situation before you plant. Yeah, and I'm a little bit familiar with Door County, and there are some trying to think of, you know, what's the nature center up in Door County? The Ridges might be a good place to pay a visit to, ask them a little bit about the possibility of some of the plants that are grown natively in that area that might help you out. But yeah, that's a tougher situation because it sounds like it's a rocky soil. So it's very, probably very dry as well on that steep slope until you get a washing rain, of course. So yeah, that's probably one that you want to consult a professional on, to take a look at the site first so that, you're dealing with it properly, because it might be a situation where, you're going to have to stop the erosion problem before you can get something established in.
Yeah,
in
and
there.
The Ridges might not be a bad place to go, because there is a, I was trying to think of a commercial professional up there who does really good work in Door County, and I can't think of his name right off the top of my head, but I'm pretty positive he's had some working relationship with the folks at the Ridges. And you might, if not somebody from the Ridges, they might suggest a local professional to come take a look, because it probably needs somebody who kind of knows what they're doing, take a look at it. But
yeah, I know there's quite a number of great landscape operations in that area. So I'm sure you can find somebody.
Let's take Gwen in Weyerhaeuser next. Hi, Gwen.
Hi there, Larry and Jeff, is it? Former caller that asked about peonies, I dashed for the phone when I heard her question, because I've had real success with peonies for several years, and they're in full sun. They're in a big middle garden in our yard. Two of them that sit on the perimeter of the garden bloomed beautifully. Two of them that sit close together on the front of the garden had little tiny buds all over them, but none of them bloomed. And I didn't know what that could be.
That's a good question.
I did have a freeze here, but the buds looked, I wondered about that bud blast thing that I Googled, but should I just separate those two plants that are kind of close together and hope for the best next year?
Yeah, it might not be a bad, you know, give it a try and see what happens. There's not a lot of factors. We got, you know, soil fertility involved. We got soil moisture. There are some diseases like botrytis is one in a wet spring that can cause the flowers to kind of turn to mush before they fully open. But all in all, peonies are pretty tough plants. Sometimes the soil conditions are even not too far away from each other can be really different because of, you know, our urban landscape and how soils are kind of messed with in the process of building a home and all those sorts of things. So, yeah, not a bad idea to maybe dig them up in the fall and relocate them and divide them into maybe a few more clumps at the same time if you want a few more. And, give them a good watering in, and then, you know, maybe a little fertilizer in the spring and see how that works. You know, it's sometimes like a rotted manure is a good way to fertilize. It's got a good sort of organic slow release fertilizer, which wouldn't be too high in nitrogen. So you might get some, you know, good flowering that way.
Yeah. Good tips. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. John in Waupaca wondered if you had some suggestions for natives to plant in wetlands in Vilas County.
Yeah, so of course, you know, we often use wetland type plants in rain gardens, or at least in portions of the rain gardens, because oftentimes, I mean, it depends on the type of wetland, but oftentimes wetlands are wet in the spring. And then as the summer wanes on, they dry up. So those plants are well adapted to both conditions, and those make the best plants for rain gardens. So something like Joe Pieweed, which we mentioned earlier, is a good one that's often seen in rain gardens. Also, one of our native milkweeds, Asclepias incarnata, is actually called the swamp milkweed, so aptly named. And, of course, it supports our wonderful monarch butterflies on top of it. So those would be two good ones. Eupatorium perfoliatum or American boneset is another one that we use in that situation. I think of some others. Vernonia is another one that does well for us. There's some of the, if you want something more in the grassy sort of look, there's a number of rushes and sedges that are tolerant of those wetter conditions as well. So again, if you hit up a native plant nursery, oftentimes they will have a plant sort of list within their catalog that lists what they sell for that very type of situation. So, again, I'm not sure of the nature of the wetland necessarily, so that might be something to talk to the people at the nursery about. You know, is it something that's constantly wet, or is it something that's more of a seasonal wetland? And that makes a difference when you're selecting plants for mm-hmm. that situation.
Sharon in Lancaster, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi.
Morning.
Hi. Say, I have a hibiscus plant, and it's 3 years old, and I have never gotten a bloom on it. It's very healthy. It's growing, but I've never gotten a flower bloom on it. Anything I can do, or?
Do you know which is it, like a tropical hibiscus, or is it one that's hardy outdoors, or what? What type of hibiscus?
I'm not sure. I move it outdoors when I know it's going to stay above 55. I don't know.
So it's in the house during the winter months, and then you put it out there, is what you're saying. Okay.
Correct. I actually have two, and I treat the other one the same way, and that one blooms year-round. But this one does not.
They may be different varieties or cultivars, so that might be part of reason one is better than the other. You know, a lot of the house plants that are selected these days are selected for longer flowering or bigger flowers or that sort of thing, more flowers on a particular plant. So anyway, you might start out with repotting the plant and making sure that you get it into some really nice potting mix, because those mixes break down over time. Something that was nutrient holding and porous and all those things, so after 3-4 years or more, loses those loses that those good characteristics. So maybe getting it giving it some nice fresh potting mix. Go to a good garden center to get that, because there's so many crummy potting mixes out there when you go to just a place that doesn't really know what they're selling as much. It's a good investment. So I would do that, and then, give it regular waterings as it needs and fertilize. So oftentimes a slow release fertilizer is nice of some sort, so that every time you water, it's getting a little bit of nutrients. Typically those last, 3-4 months or so. Any pot that you put it in, make sure it has good drainage holes in the base of it. And when you water any plant in a pot, you always want to water enough that you have water draining out the holes on the bottom. So if you don't have a tray or something, put it outside or put it in a sink when you water it, something like that. So you thoroughly moisten all that soil. That's important. It also flushes out any sort of soluble salts or toxins that might be in the water that accumulate over time, and they become damaging to the plant. If you ever have yellow tips on foliage or brown tips on foliage, that's often due to high soluble salt levels, where people are not watering thoroughly to kind of flush those out of the soil mass. So hope that helps.
Yeah, Sharon, thank you so much for calling. Just quickly, Jim wanted to know what mulch you prefer.
I prefer leaf mulch. In my garden at home, I try to utilize all of the debris that sort of so-called debris, the plant material that I have in my garden. And that's what I use as my mulch. I throw it in the lawn. I mow it up with my mulching mower and then I bag it with the mower and put it right back in the beds. And all the leaves from your trees, use them in your garden. Don't put them on the curb.
There you go. Jeff Epping, our guest today. Jeff is director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. If you haven't been to Olbrich Gardens, I highly recommend a visit. It's a wonderful place to spend some time. I feel fortunate that I live so close to it. I can make frequent trips. Always a lot of fun to talk with Jeff Epping. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. So, what gardening questions do you have? We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. A listener emailed that her Annabelle hydrangea has some sort of bug that wraps a leaf around itself and eats the leaves on the plant. I wondered if you've heard about this problem before. What can she do? She's had these hydrangea plants for many, many years.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I mean, I don't know exactly what that insect is, I'll be quite honest with you, but I would be curious to know at what percent of the leaves are actually affected by that. And one of the things that we need to think about if we're going to plant native plants, and Annabelle hydrangea is a variant of hydrangea arborescens, the smooth hydrangea that's not necessarily native in Wisconsin, but it's a little bit farther east and south. It is in Illinois, certain parts of Illinois. So when we plant native plants, what are we doing? We're planting them for the insects, and which in turn then would, you know, put them in the stomachs of the birds that we want to support, right? If we were to spray every insect that was on the native plants, we're not helping anybody. So we need to have tolerance of these holes and these missing leaves and all those sorts of things. You know, Doug Talmeade says if your plants don't have holes in them, they're not doing their job. And I love that quote. And we all need to think of things in a different way. So when we have holes in our oak tree, the leaves, the various perennials, leaf cutter bees taking bites out of some of the plants in the garden, we're now actually like happy. That makes us happy because we feel like now we're providing the food for all these insects. And that's what we have to change our mindset. Now, with that said, there are some invasive pests, right? There's gypsy moth and there's emerald ash borer. And, you know, there are some non-native insects out there that can do some serious damage. And those we want to be a little more diligent at controlling. Hopefully we do that in an organic way, because all those chemicals have an effect on the creatures that are living out in our garden. So that's I thought that was a good opportunity to say, you know,
yeah.
let those plants do their job. Let them be eaten. And they have been, you know, they're adapted to it. They can take it in most situations, especially if it's a native insect. So before you do anything, you know, learn what it is. I bet if you Googled up that information on hydrangea arborescens, you'll figure that out. Or all the great apps that are out there right now that you can take a picture of and send in, and you'll get an exact, you know, identification. And for instance, at home, I have a little native dry prairie plant, a little Antenaria or pussy toes. And I looked at it the other day, and about half the leaves were curled up. And come to find out, it's the larva, it's the caterpillar of one of our native butterflies, the painted lady butterfly, I believe, if I looked it up right. And so I was like, happy as could be, you know. And 10 years ago, I probably would have went in there and killed every little one of those little caterpillars in there because I was so worried about it eating up my plant. And now I'm rejoicing that it's getting eaten up. So, you know, it's you just got to look at things in a different way. And think of your garden as part of one of our national parks, and having your plants become part of the ecosystem that supports all of our native insects and birds. So hopefully it's a good one, and you can celebrate the fact that you have some of those leaves getting curled up and eaten.
Dolores in Fond du Lac County, your turn now. Hi, Dolores.
Okay, I just was wondering if anyone had talked about using your kitchen garbage as slurry for a flower. My mother had two peony plants, and I went to her one day and I said, "Mom, I heard about this that you could take your kitchen garbage and put it in your blender and make a slurry and use that for fertilizer." So she did that with one of her peonies. They both had seven blossoms. So she did it for one peony, not the other one. And the next year, that peony that she put the slurry on had 27 blooms. The peony that had no slurry had 7 blooms. So what the heck?
There you go. I think it's a form of composting, I would suppose. I mean, all these plants have nutrients in them, and that's why it's good that you know, we reutilize our compost and kitchen scraps. I mean, I wouldn't think about throwing any of my kitchen scraps in the garbage at home, right? They go in the compost pile, they decompose a little bit, and then I put them back out in the garden again to provide nutrients for my other plants. So that's another form of that, I guess. It's not one that I've ever heard of, but it sounds like that was a pretty cool experiment, and it worked.
For sure.
Yeah, that's how I was saying. Right? I mean, throwing all of your plant debris, plant waste, whatever you call it, out on the curb to be taken away. It's just you're throwing away money. You're throwing away something good. And think of all the energy that needs to now be used to take it off site and dispose of it somewhere else and process it somewhere else. Then you get mulch and you have somebody bring that to you and it's in a plastic bag maybe, and all that energy that goes into that. You have all what you need right in your garden. Just utilize it. And that caller makes a good point, you know, just grinding that up and look what happened. The plants loved it, right? So need to think more that way.
Thanks again, Dolores. John in Janesville, hello.
Hello. Hello, how are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. Good. What's on your mind?
So I have about a 27-year-old prairie planting about 1 acre around my home, and it's all doing well, except in the last couple of years I picked up a lot of Canada thistle, and I don't think I'll ever eradicate it, but I want to know, just suggestions I've pulled, and I've spot sprayed with 2,4-D, so any other suggestions on actual some type of control of it from your guests. I'll take my answer or the answer off the air.
Okay.
Right. Well, the good news is Canada thistle gets going a lot earlier in the spring than most of our native prairie plants. They're, you know, they like heat and they take some time to get moving. So Typically, thistle will come up early, grow several inches before there's hardly any growth around it. And even if there is some growth around it, you want to protect that. So I'm trying to remember what Neil DeBole calls it, the glove of death, I think he says. And it's basically you put a rubber glove on, one that's, you know, impenetrable to anything, and then you put some type of a cloth glove, maybe cut the fingers off of it or something. And then you can dip that glove into an herbicide. Typically, it would be Roundup or glyphosate. And then you just grab the thistle or whatever other plant it is that you might be trying to get rid of. And you just, you know, take it through your hand. And so you're coating, you don't want to rip it off. You want it to stay in place because you want it to absorb that herbicide and die. Something like Canada thistle has a huge, very extensive root system, typically underground, that you can't see. And that's what's, if you just keep pulling off the tops, you'll never get rid of it. This way, you get the herbicide onto only that plant, not damage any of the others around it. It translocates that herbicide down into that root system to end up killing it. And so it may not happen just once in one application. You might have to be a little diligent, but you can get rid of it eventually if you do the work.
There you go, John. Thanks. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Rita in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Rita.
Thank you. I have a problem with my rhubarb. Way back in May, it actually blossomed. Not both plants, but one plant. And it did that last year, too. And I don't know if that means that I didn't use those stalks. I thought maybe they would be tough or something. And what causes that to happen so early in the season?
Mine did, too. I go in and I just pull those out and just toss them. My rhubarb plants are enormous. They're the size of a Volkswagen, I think. But more rhubarb than any one person should have. But they tend to, they'll go to bloom each season, as far as I know. Mine always have. And I just go in and I just pull those out and then delay the blooming. Right now, my rhubarb is starting to get so tough that I'm not harvesting it anymore. Then if they go to bloom, I don't know if it's a big deal. But basically just pull those out and toss them in the compost pile and harvest until it gets hot and dry like it is now. And then I think they become really kind of too fibrous to eat. Yeah. I don't know if you have any comments, Larry, on that one.
No, you've said exactly the right thing, I think. I would do this. I've done the same. So there you go. Thank you, Rita. David emailed to ask what to do in areas where exotic invasives are so predominant. Brome grasses, tansy, clover, etc. How can anyone get started converting to prairie on native plants? He would have to totally kill everything with herbicide or have a greater remove the top 10 inches of soil just to get started and have a chance. It's really frustrating.
Well, I think that's probably exactly true. I've worked with a number of clients who converted agricultural fields, whether it be corn, soybeans, or whatever, into prairies. And you have to go in the beginning and treat with an herbicide to clean the slate clean, and then go in and sow the seed, typically in the fall, but it doesn't have to be. Again, there's companies that specialize in that sort of thing, and that's their deal. And so, you know, again, nobody wants to use herbicides if you don't have to, but sometimes you have to. And because of the nature of how things are these days with invasive species. So, and then again, look in the situation that we dealt with 12 acres of agricultural fields, which were herbicided many times a season or once a season for many, many years, going in one last time, getting rid of Canada thistle, even Canada goldenrod, which is a native plant, but it can be and overrun a prairie. So you have to get rid of that up front and really prep the site so that when you see it, you give yourself the very best chance for success. And typically that's not real difficult when you do it right. And so, you know, I'd say go for it, because what you're going to end up with will have so much value in the long haul. It's worth the work up front to do it right.
But do it right. Yeah. That's the main thing. There's not a shortcut there. If you do it right the first time, you're going to have much, much better success. Stan in Milwaukee, we'll go to you. Hi, Stan.
Hi, I've been waging war against Creeping Charlie coming in a neighbor's garden beds, lawns. And I've got it pretty clear for my yard, but is there any way other than herbicide treating the neighboring properties for this stuff to keep it out of mine? Or is there any maintenance I can do that can prevent it from coming in?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're not gonna get rid of it without an herbicide. But I have. I border a park. My backyard borders a park. It has Creeping Charlie in it. I always have to go out and pull it out of my garden bed. And basically, if I just go out there every 2 weeks and get it as it's encroaching in the bed, it's no big deal. It's pretty easy to just kind of pull out. And so I would say in your situation, if you kind of stay on top of it, on that leading edge where it's creeping in, that will probably be your best bet. The other thing you could do is put some type of border in there, possibly like dig down maybe 4 to 6 inches, put in, some type of edging material, or even a landscaping paver or something like that. That will at least slow it down. It'll have to kind of, if it's high enough, it probably won't be an issue at all coming over. But if it's, you're not going to build a wall, then it'll kind of come up over the top. It'll give you some more time to pull it and get rid of it or deal with it that way. Usually it doesn't seed in very readily. It's almost always the runners that are kind of just creeping in from somewhere else. So I think that's about the best you can do.
It's amazing how much a Creeping Charlie you can pick in 15 minutes. I mean, yeah, it doesn't really take a lot of time.
No. And if you take a rake, like a hard rake, a garden rake, in that, if you can, on that leading edge too, then it'll fight it back even a few more feet. It'll take a little longer to get back in. But, it's one of those that typically...
It's also the first thing to flower in the spring. And so for insects... an attractive, it can serve a purpose. Let's put it that way.
Right. And I'll be honest with you. We have an area here at the garden. It's kind of on one of our perimeter areas where it's so shady that none of the grass, sort of the fescues that we have established there live anymore. And it's a mass of Creepy Charlie. And we just decided like, you know what? Why fight it? It's actually beautiful, right? It's got a beautiful little leaf. It's got a beautiful purple flower. I think we've just been trained that it's a bad, bad plant. And if you want to have a good lawn, you can't have Creeping Charlie in it. But it does become a problem when it's starting to get, kind of go through all of your perennial beds and such. So that's where I worry about keeping it out of a lawn area. It does well where other plants don't. And that's why, it's there.
Someone else wondered about, this dry conditions and water. What do we do for our plants? Do we get out there and water them?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So first, this is a good lesson. When we have a year like this, it's a good lesson as to what plants we should have in our garden, maybe shouldn't have in our garden. A lot of plants that, a lot of non-native plants that aren't particularly drought tolerant. And we have them in our gardens and we water them, a little bit through the season. But in a season like this, you have to water them a lot. And those plants probably aren't best suited for us. I'm thinking of something like astilbe which I don't know that we have more than a handful here at the garden. And if we do, they're in areas that are low and wet. And so they're doing okay. But in my home garden, I don't have a single one. Beyond that, mulching is an important one. It helps hold the soil moisture in when we do irrigate, and, you know, cools the soils, keeps the sun from baking them, to give our plants a better, healthier root system, which is important to keep them alive and you know, survive these super dry periods like we're having here in Madison right now. If we do irrigate, it's best to irrigate in the evening or very early morning hours is probably the very best. Here at the garden, we do have an irrigation system that can be programmed. It's like mini computers on them, and we program, from 1 a.m. till probably 5 a.m, somewhere, you know, in that range when we need to. It's best to water, when you do water, water thoroughly and more deeply, rather than spritz a little water on every day, because, you know, most of that just evaporates and encourages shallow root systems rather than deeper. And then accept the fact that your garden's not going to be awesome this year. We're in a survival mode, right? We want to keep the plants alive, but they're not going to be their typical, year when we have a fantastic growing season with ample rain. So, forgive yourself or forgive your plants for not being their normal, beautiful self, and we'll get through it all. And hopefully the rains will return before too long. Lawns are a huge consumptive water, watering plant in our gardens. And during times like this, it's okay to let them go dormant. Let them turn brown, go dormant. There'll be a certain point where you'll need to give them a little water so that you don't lose the lawn. But Larry, I'll have an expert, a lawn expert, turf expert on that subject before too long if he hasn't already. Speak better on that than I. I'm not a big lawn guy, I'll admit. So it's I like as little as very as possible. Here at Olbrich, we only have enough lawn to suit the needs of our events, concerts and parties and that sort of thing. And what used to be lawn is now gardens instead. And, that they have serve a bigger purpose, maybe, in my opinion.
Well, Jeff, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I'm going to see if I can't get over to Olbrich on the weekend, take a look. I haven't been over there for a couple of weeks, so we'll see what's going on over there.
Yeah, it's great. We have a lot more people in the garden this year, and it's great. Everybody's loving it. And, check out our website. We got some events coming up now, and lots of fun ahead.
Yeah. Jeff Epping, Director of Horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. Thank you so much for listening today. Please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.